Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you ever get the feeling that the world belongs to Big Soda and we're just living in it?
It's summer swinging with the Everly Brothers.
Sitting in my lifeguard seat, out here in the sun and heat, watching that the little girls don't drown.
I mean, even when you want to, you can't get their jingles out of your head. Coke and Pepsi sponsor everything from Super Bowl halftime to American Idol to polar bears. They're everywhere.
Things go better with Coca-Cola. Things go better with Coke.
Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the nutritional, political, environmental, and economic consequences of Big Soda.
It's a real thing.
For instance, Coke and Pepsi sponsor a lot of sports. I guess that's where people get thirsty. Coke's name is all over the Olympics and FIFA soccer. Pepsi brings us the NBA, Major League Baseball, and, of course, Super Bowl halftime. And yet, chances are pretty good that most of the players on those fields don't drink soda. Because it's not healthy. So why are we all still drinking it? And even more interesting, who exactly is drinking it? Food industry activist Marion Nessel says poor, working class, and minority communities. That's who. Nessel is a nutrition and public health professor at New York University, and she's a longtime anti-soda advocate. In her latest book, Soda Politics, she makes the case that soft drinks are increasingly about race and class.
Because that's where the markets are targeted. The soda companies have deliberately targeted their marketing to people of color, to people who don't have much money. They appeal to people emotionally. Sodas are cheap. It's a cheap pleasure. Everybody can afford it. And what the soda industry has done is to market the products as something that's a substitute for water. It markets happiness. It markets family values. It markets aspirational achievement. It uses people who are professional athletes and professional musicians, really famous people, are spokespersons for usually Coca-Cola or PepsiCo. And all of this is very greatly appealing to people who don't have a lot of money or education. Because the word is out that sodas are not good for health, educated people who have money aren't drinking them so much anymore.
Because I was going to say, you know, for at least a decade, maybe two, health advocates have done a lot to change the public perception of soda. And I guess my sense is that a lot of that has worked. So, I mean, would you agree that consumers today are generally more aware that drinking a lot of sugary soda is bad for you?
Well, it depends on who you are. If you're educated, pay attention to those kinds of issues, you know that. And you know it well enough to have stopped drinking liquid sugar, which is what these products are. If you're not, then you don't know it, and you are furious if people try to tell you that you shouldn't be drinking these things.
Is there a backdrop to that? Because I notice it's sort of ironic. In your book, you point out that back in the 50s and early 60s, African-American protesters often were angry at the big soda companies because they weren't marketing to their communities.
Yeah, it's actually an incredible story. And I title the chapter in the book, Marketing to African-American and Hispanic Americans, a complicated story, because it's really complicated. Starting in the 1940s, 1950s, there were enormous protests against soda companies because they wouldn't advertise in African-American or Hispanic publications and they wouldn't hire African-Americans in the company. One of the things I discovered during the research was that Martin Luther King, on the night before he was assassinated, gave a speech in which he called on his followers to boycott Coca-Cola because it wasn't hiring members of the community. And that was a battle that the minority community won to some extent. Coca-Cola, after all, is a Southern company. It's based in Atlanta. And it was a long time coming before the company really began to embrace the community and realize that they were customers just like any other customer. But they didn't want to be perceived as catering to the African-American community the way that Pepsi did first. So there was a sort of white and black perception of the companies early on.
Wait, really? So Coke was supposedly the white drink and Pepsi was the African-American drink?
Yeah, back in the 50s. And then that changed, of course, when companies began to realize that there were a huge number of customers who could be reached if they were treated a little bit better. But the companies are still having trouble with race relations over hiring practices, differentials in pay, and other kinds of things. I mean, these problems have carried forward. But what I'm interested in is what happened when obesity became a big problem. Obesity is a larger problem in low-income minority communities. Therefore, public health efforts focused on drinking less soda need to focus on the poorer communities. And then you get into really complicated issues of regressive taxes and issues that health advocates are up against. So if you're arguing for a soda tax is going to hurt the poor more than the rich. But on the other hand, obesity hurts the poor more than the rich. So these are tough issues to deal with.
We're talking about the things that big soda, quote unquote, is doing to kind of shape the public discussion about soda. And this is one of the main points that you make in the new book, is that it's not simply a matter anymore of consumers gathering information and then being able to make educated choices about, you know, what to drink or what not to drink, that a lot of the public perception is being shaped in ways that we often don't see or don't realize. For example,
well, the one that bothers me the most and that I'm most concerned about these days is Coca-Cola and the American Beverage Association's sponsorship of research studies. These research studies invariably come out with results that favor the marketing interests of these companies or trade associations. And the studies are designed to show that sodas have nothing to do with health. They don't raise obesity levels in adults or children. They don't cause diabetes. They're not associated with diabetes. And the one that actually really disturbs me the most is that the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is the major United States nutrition monitoring survey, the Coca-Cola and American Beverage Association funded studies all come out with results that say that this survey is so flawed that you shouldn't pay any attention to anything that it says.
Well, I don't understand how anybody can do a scientific study suggesting that there's no connection between drinking a lot of sugary soda and obesity or diabetes. If you're going to drink a lot of sugar, aren't those going to be the results?
Yeah, I mean, my doctorate is in molecular biology, and I've, you know, studied science for a long time. And I think it's really easy to design a study to give you the answer that you want. All you have to do is not control it very well, is to ask a question that is going to give you the answer that you want. These aren't open-ended studies. These are studies that are designed to give the answer that the investigator wants. And whether this is conscious or unconscious, I can't say. I suspect it's unconscious, which makes it even more difficult to deal with. Most people who accept money from soda companies for their research think it has no effect on what they do.
Mm. I think they've also sponsored a lot of research recently suggesting that exercise is much more important than diet. That even if you eat, you know, a terrible diet with lots of sugar, that the main way to avoid obesity and all the problems associated with it is just exercise.
Yeah, that's where the New York Times revelations came in. The New York Times did an enormous story last August demonstrating that a group called the Global Energy Balance Network, based in the University of Colorado, which was designed and organized specifically to promote the idea that how active you are is much more important than what you eat in your weight status, that organization was totally funded and backed by buy Coca-Cola. Oh, did that look bad? And it caused an enormous, enormous public relations disaster for Coca-Cola, which the company is still dealing with. Now, the issue of physical activity versus what you eat is an important one, and physical activity is really important in health, absolutely. But if you are using physical activity to work off excess calories, you have a big problem because it's very hard to do. So the most obvious example is, let's say, a 20-ounce soda, which has 275 calories. My rule of thumb is that it takes about a mile of walking or running to work off 100 calories. So that's 3 miles.
That's a fair amount.
Which a lot of people can't fit into their daily activities very easily. Some people can, some people can't. But to the idea that you're going to work off soda calories by physical activity is a fantasy. It just can't be done unless you're a really serious physical activity nut.
Is there anything we can do to fight back against big soda?
Oh, I think there are lots of things we can do. For one thing, we can vote with our fork or with our spoon and stop drinking sugary drinks. That's the first thing, and that's what's happening. Sales are way, way down in the United States. But then I think we have to get involved in these political campaigns. The United Nations has just come out saying that soda taxes are a really great way to reduce consumption of sodas. People can get behind soda tax campaigns. And I think we need to do that not only in the United States, but we also need to be very, very concerned about what soda companies are doing in the developing world, because they are putting billions of dollars into marketing in Asia, India, and Africa. Coca-Cola, for example, has said that it will put $29 billion into advertising and marketing and bottling plants in Africa between 2010 and 2020. And I just saw something that they're going to put $1 billion into marketing in Argentina.
Wow.
These are all countries that do not need their populations drinking a lot of sugary drinks.
Marion Nassel is the author of Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. The American Beverage Association issued a statement in response to the book. We are always interested in new opportunities to make more meaningful changes to improve public health.
Coke has a taste you never get tired of. Coke after Coke, Coke after Coke, Coke after Coke.
My soda doesn't clog my teeth.
Now for a lively link. Ice cold Coca-Cola. There's no waistline worry with Coke, you know. Actually, this individual size bottle has no more calories than half a grapefruit.
My one and only advice is Coke. Coca-Cola and ice. My one and only advice is Coca-Cola and ice.
Laurence Olivier for Diet Coke.
Hello, I'm Laurence Olivier. I've been dead for over 2 years.
Now,
but through the marvelous technology of tape editing,
I'm able to
speak to you from beyond the grave.
What you are
listening to
right now
was made by
cutting
together
things I said
in my many
films and interviews.
Although I
never would have
endorsed
a product
like this
when I was
alive,
my estate
has determined
that if I was
alive,
I would really
want to tell you
how much I
enjoy the
taste of
Diet
Coca-Cola. I think Diet
Coca-Cola
is really
excellent,
dude.
It's awesome. I wish I could
have some
now,
but I can't
because
I'm
dead.
But
take it from me,
Laurence Olivier.
Maketh thy
mouth
alive
with
Diet
Coca-Cola. It's everything you
want it
to be.
That's the Canadian sketch comedy trio, The Vestibules, formerly known as Radio Free Vestibule. And here's a pop quiz, pun intended. What popular carbonated soft drink was originally marketed under the name Bib Label Lithiated Lemon Lime Soda? The answer? 7-Up. The drink was launched in October 1929 and originally included a small amount of lithium citrate, which explains the name. That's just one of many obscure soda facts in Tristan Donovan's book, Fizz, How Soda Shook Up the World. Doug Gordon sat down with him to uncover the secret history of soft drinks.
Tristan, we can't really talk about the history of fizzy water without talking about what gives it its fizz, the carbonation process. Who discovered carbonation?
Joseph Priestley was the guy behind it. He was a scientist and theologian in Britain in the 1700s. People had been working their way towards it. They'd worked out what carbon dioxide was and how to make it. They'd discovered there were minerals in water, but no one had worked out how to actually make the water fizz. And he lived in the city of Leeds, and near his house was a brewery. And he went in there and started doing experiments over the vats where the beer was brewing, which produces a lot of carbon dioxide. And he started sort of moving water back and forth between two vessels. And by doing it quickly enough, he managed to start capturing some of the gas inside the water. So that was kind of the big breakthrough. And then he developed the special apparatus for pumping the carbon dioxide under pressure into the water so it got trapped there, sort of using a pig's bladder to kind of pump it.
Did he think that, in keeping in line with the mindset of the time of fizzy water having medicinal properties, did Priestley think it was possibly going to offer some sort of cure for something?
Oh, yeah. He thought he had made this wonderful breakthrough in healthcare. One of the first things that happened after he revealed his apparatus is they gave it to the explorer James Cook to take on his ships for his voyages around the world. And the thinking was, by having the ability to make fizzing water on the journey, they'd be able to cure themselves of scurvy and survive the journey. So they thought it was a massive breakthrough. James Cook's ship didn't get scurvy, but that was because they were taking in fresh fruit whenever they stopped. So it was a little disappointing for him that it wasn't anything to do with the fizzing water, but they still believed there was something good about it.
What is it about the fizzy water that people enjoy so much?
First of all, the drinks tend to be sweet, and we do like sweet things.
Yes.
But also, I think it's just a bit more interesting than your normal drink. If you're just going to drink water, it's fine, it's nice, but it's fairly plain. All these drinks had kind of all these bizarre tastes, and, you know, it was much more exciting to have it fizzing. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just more attractive and more fun, and so people bought into the idea that, well, it might not cure all my illnesses, but this is fun to drink and tasty and sweet and, you know, great on a cold day. I mean, a warm day.
Yeah. And then it makes me think also of the line from Bubblicious or some other chewing gum, there's a party in my mouth. So it's like having a party in your mouth.
Yeah. And you got the tang of the phosphoric acid, that little kind of bite you get in Coca-Cola and so on. And, you know, the bubbles fizzing on your tongue. So I think it was sort of quite, you know, and even in the 80s when I was growing up, it was still quite a magical thing. It was quite unusual to, you know, you have fizzing lemonade. And it was like, ooh, what's going on in my mouth?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Defending the world from tyranny, paving the road to victory. Coca-Cola leading the charge.
When the U.S. entered World War II, Coca-Cola executives managed to convince the American government that Coke was this kind of liquid morale booster. And by September 1942, supplying the troops with Coke had become basically official U.S. Army policy. And when the U.S. sent 20,000 troops to the British island of Trinidad to protect it from attack by the Nazis, and the sight of the troops with their Cokes and the way they were going after the women inspired this local calypso singer named Lord Invader to write a protest song. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, basically he saw all these American GIs with their Coca-Cola and drinking lots of rum and Coke, because rum was sort of the big liquor there. And essentially he kind of felt, you know, they're wooing the women away from us. So, you know, there was this kind of envy, and they had money, which the local people didn't really have. So it was really kind of, you know, these Americans are coming in and they're taking away our women, and they've got all this money and we don't. So it's a bit of a protest song.
And when the Yankees first went to Trinidad, some of the young girls were more than glad. They said that the Yankees treat them nice, and they give them a better price. They buy rum and Coca-Cola, when Dung Point Kumana, both mothers and daughters, working for the Yankee dollar.
Rather ironically, he didn't have much success with the song himself, but the Andrew Sisters covered it later and it became a hit.
If you ever go down Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
Yeah, and then one thing that I was surprised to learn, that it was kind of reworked a bit, and according to Wikipedia, when it ended up in the hands and recorded by the Andrew Sisters, because the song was plagiarized by Maury Amsterdam, the guy who's probably best known for playing Buddy Sorrell on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Is that right? And Amsterdam copyrighted it, and then the Andrew Sisters rejigged it, and it became this huge hit.
Yeah, it's bizarre to sort of have this basically a song that started off as this sort of almost anti-American protest kind of go up to the top of the charts.
Well, I guess by the time the Andrew Sisters reworked it, it wasn't considered a protest song, because if it were, I would think Coke would come out with its protest song to protest the protest song.
Yeah, yeah. I think they may have intervened if it stayed in its original form.
Working for the Yankee dollar.
In recent years, we've seen the emergence of small soda and this craft soda movement, small operations like Jones Soda, Brooklyn Soda Works, and Wisco Pop here in Wisconsin. What are these artisanal soda makers doing differently from big soda?
I think what they're doing is bringing it back to the producers. So it feels local, it feels small, it feels more natural than this kind of slightly sterile cans that roll off by the millions from the production lines everywhere. You see it in all different types of areas of society at the moment, that people are trying to get back to what's real rather than this big manufactured experience, which is what Coca-Cola and Pepsi ultimately offer. So lots of people have been kind of going, well, actually, it's quite easy to make soda. The equipment's quite cheap. I'll give that a try, and then I can experiment with new flavors, and we'll do something weird with ginger and celery or whatever it may be. And this been picking up, and so, you know, sort of local food markets and things, it sells them there. And I think it feels more individual to people. It feels less like, oh, if I buy Coca-Cola, it's, you know, I'm just one of many millions of people. But if I buy a drink from Brooklyn Soda Works, then, you know, it's more individual to me.
And then Jones Soda, one of the early craft soda companies, and they've been around a while, and maybe they're too big to be considered part of small soda, but they've done interesting things. Like when they first started, they invited consumers to send photos, which they would use as labels on the bottles, which of course really helps develop a sense of ownership. They've had some crazy flavors, haven't they?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sort of meat flavored sodas and things
like
that.
Yeah, turkey and gravy for Thanksgiving, and all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah, and there's some appeal in it, and just like, I know it's going to be bad, but how bad is it? I'll give it a try.
You got to try it. Yeah, it's the gross out factor.
Yeah.
Impress your friends by how willing you are to be a risk taker and try turkey and gravy soda.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Tristan, do you drink soda?
Yeah, I do. Mainly Coke Zero, but I do like kind of quite a range. So I don't drink it as much as I used to.
I'm curious about the future of soda. I wonder if maybe we've reached peak soda, a time when big soda sales are going to continue to decline as people become more aware of the health risks, and a time also when the craft soda movement may grow and take more market share away from big soda. What do you think about the future of soda?
Yeah, I think we've passed peak soda quite some time ago. In 1998 was the height of soda sales in the US.
Okay, so we're post-peak.
Yeah, and it's been in steady decline year on year ever since. So the sales are definitely dropping. We're moving to water. We're moving away from soda. What I think the craft soda movement may do is pretty much like what's already happened with craft beer. People will start moving away from kind of what would have been Miller Lights and Coors or Budweiser or whatever it was, and going for these more craft type sodas. And they wouldn't have them quite so often, but it'll be a more interesting drink to have. And I think that will happen, and that will chip away a bit more. But I think it's the health worries and the worries about putting on too much weight that are driving most people to reduce their soda consumption.
The girls' girl watchers watch what they drink. They watch for true cola taste and watch out for aftertaste.
Tristan Donovan talking with Doug Gordon. Tristan's the author of Fizz, How Soda Shook Up the World. Coming up, we'll find out how the Coca-Cola Company became one of the world's most beloved and iconic brands. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Want to know what global power really looks like? Pick up a can of Coke. That red label is one of the world's most valuable brands. Coca-Cola is the world's largest beverage company. It operates 900 plants, sells in more than 200 countries. Worldwide, it serves more than 1.9 billion drinks a day. That's like roughly one for every four people on Earth. So how did Coca-Cola become such a powerhouse? Bart Elmore is the guy to ask. He's the author of a new environmental history of the company called Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Bart, you say that Coca-Cola kind of pioneered a new kind of capitalism, what you call Coca-Cola capitalism.
Right. And I should be clear that this thing I call Coca-Cola capitalism was somewhat of, not a mistake, but something that wasn't planned. This is a strategy for making money that involves getting others to do work for you. And I argue that Coca-Cola really came up with this strategy out of necessity. And the guy who starts Coca-Cola is a broke morphine addict living in Atlanta, Georgia, right? He doesn't have a lot of capital, doesn't have a lot of resources.
This is back in the late 19th century.
Right, around 1886 when Coca-Cola first emerges. And, you know, how do you make a buck when you don't have anything? You try and find ways to kind of insert yourself into infrastructure that others have. And so that's what Coke did. You know, it didn't own its bottlers for most of its history. It didn't own sugar plantations, decaffeination plants, high fructose corn syrup wet mills. It relied on others to invest in that infrastructure. And it kind of acted as a commodity broker between independent producers and distributors, making money off the flow of ecological capital through its system, but never really making stuff.
Well, let's talk about how this actually works in practice. For instance, it turns out that the Coca-Cola syrup doesn't come with sugar. The bottlers have to source the sugar locally. How does that actually work in practice?
Right. So just to be clear, this is for overseas bottlers. So in the United States, bottling contracts were written up in a way that Coca-Cola had to supply the sweetener. But in the 1920s, Coca-Cola got a very smart idea as they started going overseas. They said, why should we pay for this sugar, which is the most expensive ingredient that goes into their product? Why don't we write contracts with our bottlers that say they have to supply the sugar themselves? And so what Coca-Cola sells overseas is a concentrate that doesn't even contain the main thing that a lot of people drink the drink for, which is the sugar.
So what is Coke actually selling overseas? Just a syrup without sugar, and then the local bottlers have to add the sugar to it?
Steve, right. It's a sleek system, isn't it, right? Basically, what they would say is we're selling the secret formula, those secret ingredients, the decoconized coca leaf extract, okay, which is they still have in there this kind of essence of the coca leaf that they get from Peru, various tinctures, cassia oil from China. I mean, all these little things that make up their so-called secret formula, which is actually not that secret. That's what they're selling to these bottlers. And it's the bottlers who pay for the water, the packaging, the sugar, you know, the infrastructure, the trucks and the gas to get this stuff to market. It's a really smart system from Coke's perspective.
Now, one of the most amazing pieces of this story that I found as I was reading your book was how water figures into Coca-Cola. And I had no idea that Coke uses so much water from all around the world.
Yes. And again, this is part of the strategy, right? Not owning your own system of distribution. For most of their history, they relied on local bottlers who tapped in mainly to public water supplies in the United States and even in other parts of the world to access their water. And it's a remarkable story. I mean, they consume roughly around 79 billion gallons of water a year just at their bottling plants. But what's really interesting about that statistic, which you'll often see, is that doesn't even reflect the amount of water that's used to produce the agricultural crops and the bottles and the various materials that they use to sell their product. If you actually calculated those water inputs, the water used to grow the sugarcane and everything else, I calculated that they would be consuming about as much water as would come out to about 7 trillion gallons of water. So a lot of water, enough to, I think, provide cleaning and drinking water for about a fourth of the world's population each year. So this is a big water footprint, not just from the bottling, which is what most people focus on, but actually, if you look at the whole system, producing all these ingredients is actually where the real story is.
And you're saying that, I mean, part of the story here is that you've got to tap into the local water supplies, and you know, if there's a limited amount of water, you can actually drain those water resources.
Right, and I went to Rajasthan, India in 2010, where Coca-Cola was facing a lot of heat because they were in a region of India that was particularly arid, and they were extracting large quantities of water, and the villagers and people around the community were getting upset. And I was a graduate student with not a lot of money, but, you know, I said, my advisor said, well, I guess you got to go to India. So I got on a plane. I went through Kuwait, and I think it was one of those flights that you get on, you know, budget air. I mean, it was certainly graduate student fare, and showed up at this bottling plant and actually had arranged to talk with somebody at Coca-Cola. When I showed up, they did not want to meet with me. So I'd flown all this way, and, you know, I was really upset. So, but I got to get a sense of what was going on at the bottling plant nonetheless. And independent NGOs had done some studies there, and they accurately pointed out that, look, agriculture is the biggest user of water. We know that. But these bottling plants can have an effect and do have an effect on exacerbating water scarcity issues in these regions of the world. And so I think this has become a real issue. Today, I don't think I have to go to India anymore to tell this story. I mean, I think we're seeing similar stories in California, where people are suggesting, wait a minute, when we're having these big droughts, what's the obligation of a company like Coca-Cola or Nestle or others in terms of extracting water during those times?
Does Coca-Cola actually study how much water is available at different places around the world? I mean, if water is crucial to their product in all these different countries?
Absolutely. You know, they're very interested in this issue. And I should say that I think there's some really good people at Coca-Cola who are trying to think about how to improve their water use efficiency, how to improve their water footprint. And that's important to me. You know, my story and the story of Coca-Cola is not a story of corporate villains heedlessly going around the world just trying to destroy the planet. I think a lot of people at Coke want to do the right thing. I think the problem is this is a really difficult ship to turn around. It's a big operation that has expanded again to 200 countries. And some of the piecemeal efficiencies that they're doing to try and change their water footprint are really not solving some of the fundamental problems of operating in certain areas of the world, really where they shouldn't be operating in terms of water.
What happens then if there isn't much water available in a particular area, particular country? I mean, does Coke shut down its bottling plants then?
Well, what was really interesting to me is that Coca-Cola in the early 2000s created what I call a kind of treasure map. They basically created this digital map that shows water scarcity and water stress levels around the world. And it's a gorgeous map. And they actually donated this to the World Resource Institute in around 2004. You can go online and look this up, this map at the World Resource Institute's webpage. And you see the world, and it literally looks like a treasure map. You can see where there's water supplies. They did all this intense scientific investigations of hydrology. The world is kind of in red and blue. So I took that map in the late 2000s and said, okay, here's the map that Coca-Cola had in front of them in the early 2000s. Let me put over this map some bottling plants and see whether they got out of some of the most water-stressed regions that this map clearly indicates. And what I found was that the answer was no, that, you know, we see bottling plants in some of these regions capable of extracting over 300 million liters of water a year that are still in some of the most dead red areas of that map. You know, I think that's the question, is really fundamentally questioning whether that's being a sound and sustainable business, being in those types of areas.
What should we make of this whole history? Because, I mean, Coke over the years has portrayed itself as a good corporate citizen, and yet doesn't sound like that from the history that you've just laid out for us.
Well, I think, and I should say this, you know, I grew up in Coke country. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia.
You grew up drinking Coca-Cola too?
And I grew up drinking Coca-Cola pretty much every day, if not two doses a day. look, I saw their philanthropy. My education was in part funded with Coke money. Robert Woodruff, who ran the firm, went to my high school. I passed his statue every day going into school. Gave a little nod. Thank you for helping me do this. My dad went to Emory University, a school that was funded with Coke money. I mean, was made possible through Coke, you know, and he got a great education. There's no doubt that Coke has done a lot of good things. Again, this isn't a story of corporate villains. For me, a lot of these solutions go beyond Coke. I don't think Coke is going to right the problems that we're seeing here. I think we as a public have an obligation to create the environment that will inspire businesses to do the right thing by, for example, putting prices on pollution, by perhaps keeping closer watch on our public water resources, by perhaps not buying bottled water, but actually investing in our public water infrastructure that's in dire need of financial support here in the United States. I mean, we spend an outrageous amount of money on bottled water at rates where we're paying 1,000 times what we'd pay if we just drank the same water out of the tap, you know?
Right.
And yet we're seeing these huge budgetary crises. So for me, it's not so much about trying to talk to Coca-Cola about how they can fix their corporate system as much as it is about trying to talk to the broader public about what is it that we can be doing to create the right types of business environments that create a healthy environment and also, you know, a healthy citizenry physically.
Bart Elmore talking with Steve Paulson. Bart teaches history at the University of Alabama, and he's the author of Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism. And as a kind of sidebar or postscript, as long as we had Bart in the studio, we had to ask him about that persistent rumor that Coca-Cola contains cocaine, or used to. The Coca-Cola Company, of course, denies the presence of cocaine in any of its drinks, past or present. But what does Bart say?
The original formula for Coca-Cola would have contained coca leaves that would have contained the alkaloid that is in cocaine. That's cocaine, essentially. And in 1903, Asa Candler, who ran the company, was a Methodist Sunday school teacher. He was puritanical by all accounts, really became concerned about the association between cocaine and black crime in the South. This was the Jim Crow era, and there was no national law prohibiting the sale of cocaine in the United States at this time in 1903. But he was looking at his regional surroundings and hearing a lot of talk that cocaine was associated with black crime. Of course, this was a racist theory at the time, but he didn't want his drink associated with that in the Jim Crow South, and so he decided to remove the cocaine.
Is that to say that before that, I mean, in the late 1800s, that you really could get a cocaine buzz from drinking Coca-Cola?
By all accounts, it would not have been a significant buzz. There are reports that after several drinks, you might have potentially had a sensation of numbing on the tongue. It was a very small amount, but it was in there nonetheless. And so in 1903, he decides to take out the cocaine. But here's the crazy story. He's so obsessed with this secret formula for Coca-Cola that he wants to keep the essence of the coca leaf in Coca-Cola. And so what he does is he sends coca leaves to a company in Maywood, New Jersey, which de-coconizes the coca leaf, essentially taking out the cocaine. And then that cocaine is actually sold to hospitals and to doctors for legitimate medicinal uses. It's used as a local eye anesthetic and for other things. And the leftover stuff, the coca leaf without the cocaine, well, that became one of the secret ingredients in Coca-Cola and remained so through the 21st century. I actually traveled to Peru to confirm that story. And yeah, they still have this trade going in Peru for this secret ingredient in their drink. Cocaine.
Bart Elmore talking with Steve Paulson.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey bees and snow white turtle doves.
Do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life? Or do you want to come with me and change the world?
And that's it for our conversation about Big Soda. We hope you found it refreshing. Coming up, Super Bowl 50 is here, so football is on our minds. Mark Edmondson tells us why it matters. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. With the Carolina Panthers facing off against the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, football is on our minds this week. For millions of fans, kicking back every Sunday to cheer or cry while your favorite teams compete is a happy weekly ritual, just part of the good life. But for English professor Mark Edmondson, the football field is a staging ground for some of life's most important lessons. In his book, Why Football Matters, Edmondson looks back on the years he played the game in high school and reflects on how it taught him courage, resilience, determination, and lots of other values. He talked with Raymond Tungekar about why football continues to inspire him.
Well, my first introduction to the game was watching it with my dad. And my dad was like a 50s dad who, you know, had the cigarettes, had the beer. And he was also kind of a hyperactive dad. He was a restaurant cook and he didn't stay still much so I could talk to him or hang with him. But there was an exception, and that was when the New York Football Giants came on. Then he would sit down, glued to the TV set, some commentary. But there he was, and I could do something with him, and that was to watch the Giants.
And so you grew up kind of venerating this game. And eventually, in high school, you decided to actually try out for the team. And it's worth pointing out that growing up, you weren't really athletic, you had asthma, you had poor eyesight. So what compelled you to sign up?
I had a tremendous amount going for me, didn't I? I had always enjoyed playing in the park. I liked the guys who played on the team. I knew some of them. And the game had fascinated me from the time that I was a boy. And I think that when I watched those great players, I had probably formed the resolution that someday down the line I would try to play myself. I didn't know what the standard was for making the team, and it turned out that it was sheer attrition. We started out with about 125 guys, and they dropped like flies. And so there was no cutting on the team, per se, lucky for me, or else I would have been gone. But I would say 60 or 70 of the guys who looked to me ferociously tough guys, gang guys, some of them South Medford Bears, some of them, they quit the team, and lo and behold, I was able to stay around.
And each chapter in your book reads kind of like this miniature lesson plan where you detail a specific virtue that you learned from the sport. And, you know, early on in the book, you write about courage. So how did football train you to be more courageous?
Well, the whole courage thing is a little bit more complicated than I would have imagined. I thought that there are people who just were courageous and could draw upon courage. And that clearly wasn't me. So in order to do the things that it purportedly took guts to do, I had to take a different route. And the route that I took was a little distressing when you look back on it. I would remember, just before I was going to have to run into somebody, I would remember something that had really humiliated me or made me angry. And I would bring that thought to mind, and I would become enraged by it, or at least pretty distressed by it. And that would allow me to go slamming into other people. Eventually, this is a strange kind of therapy, I guess. Eventually, I didn't need the thoughts anymore, and I was happy to slam into other people. It didn't hurt nearly as much as I thought it would, number one. And number two, it hurt a heck of a lot less when you were the slammer rather than the slammee.
Well, another lesson that you describe has to do with coping with loss, which seems, you know, pretty obvious. Of course, football will teach you that. But your experience actually gave you a unique, more nuanced insight into different kinds of loss.
Well, yes. One of the lines that I'm proudest of in the book, looking back, is the line that says, games matter so much because they don't matter much at all. And that is, you get to act out within the theater of different kinds of sports, feelings and aspirations and forms of discipline and forms of connection with other people that are symbolic and displaced rather than actual. I was surprised how much it hurt to lose a football game, even one that I'd barely played in. Tears and sorrow and grief and lamentation, right? But it was a rehearsal for other forms of loss that take place in life. Now, it happened that I had had a very serious and deep form of loss not too much before I started playing football. We had lost my sister Barbara Ann, you know, there was, I saw similarities between those two states of loss. There was one of them that was mortal and horrible and irreversible, and another one that was theatrical and provisional and play-acted in a certain sense, but it taught you something nonetheless.
Do you recall like a moment in which, you know, these lessons that you learned from football helped you cope with the loss of your sister, Barbara Ann?
You know, the more stuff you lose, the better you get at it. But I do think that you can acquire some kind of intuitive knowledge about the dynamics of loss. There's a great essay, which I mentioned in my book by Sigmund Freud, called Mourning and Melancholia, about the dynamics of loss. And he says a lot about it, and it's an astonishingly brilliant essay. But one of the main things he says about it is, if you're reasonably sane, there's nothing you have to do. The work of mourning will take place on its own. It has a certain kind of trajectory, and if you're patient, it will come to an end, right? But when it does come to an end, you've got to learn how to take up and go back to work and go back to your life again. You cannot stay there in a prolonged way. And that was something my coaches taught me, and it was something that my mother also taught me in her reaction to my sister's death.
Well, there's one game in particular that you write about that I found so heartbreaking. It's this game. I forgot who the other team was, but you describe this terrific loss and the bus ride back. It's just you and all your teammates on this bus sniffling and crying.
Yes. I had never experienced this before. All these big, tough guys are crying and moaning and weeping and bewailing themselves. It sounded like, you know, the women at the fall of Troy or something. And the coach let us nurse it for a while, but then he said, you know, he respected it and he understood it. But then he put us back to work and said, this is coming to an end now, fellas. No more of this sort of stuff. And we responded to him. He was good.
Well, so by now, it should be pretty clear that, you know, you're kind of ambivalent when it comes to football. I mean, you clearly have a soft spot for the sport, but you realize that, you know, it can have kind of a dark side.
Oh, it's definitely got a dark side, but I am a big fan of football as a form of education for certain kinds of young people, right? I mean, it's a place that you can learn cohesion with a group, you can learn following other people, you can learn toughness, you can learn spiritedness, you can learn how to lose. All those things are great.
Well, your son for a while also played football, right?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was a terrific player. He was this little tiny guy and he was ferocious and he ran down the quarterbacks and he ran down the halfbacks and they called him Pitbull. And I always knew that you weren't supposed to kind of gain satisfaction for your own inadequacies as a child through the activities of your child. But I thought this was perfect. I could do this just once and it would be all right. And at a certain point, it became clear to me, as it became clear to Matthew, he didn't really like football that much. He was playing because, like me, he had a lot of things that he was mad at. And when he left the game, he was happy to leave. Hmm. And I was happy for him to leave.
So did football also for him have the same effect that it did for you? That it was kind of this, it was kind of like a spiritual balm for you in a way, right?
It was. My son played when he was much younger. You know, he was 7, 8, 9 years old. I think he just had a good time. He was good at it. He had some frustrations, more than a few. This gave him a vehicle to act out those frustrations in a way that got him lots of applause. I mean, Howie Long, one of the greatest football players who ever lived, was an admirer of my son's game for a while.
Wait, really? Howie Long?
Howie Long,
yeah. How did that come out?
Well, Howie lives in Charlottesville and is, you know, a kindly, civic-minded fellow. And he had a son on the team and he used to come to practice and come to games, and he was very generous with his presence and with his praise for the kids. You know, I just picked out Matthew a couple of times as a real dynamite player. And I love that. Matthew loved that.
Okay. Well, I don't think we can avoid talking about some of the criticisms, especially, you know, players' health and well-being. So you acknowledge that football could provide an education, but there are clear downsides for the people, for the players involved. I mean, do you feel some kind of moral ambivalence watching the sport, at least at the professional level?
No, I don't. The men who are playing that game have made a choice to play that game. It's a beautiful game, lively game, exciting game. They make a tremendous amount of money. They have a blast. There are people, and there have always been from the time that history began, who decide that they're going to throw everything they have into their youths and middle age and old age may not be quite so wonderful. And now we have the information to put on the table in front of people and say, here are the risks you're taking. Do you still want to go? And the answer in many cases is, yes, indeed, I do. If you start to think about the professions that are dangerous, well, you'd have to get rid of race car drivers. You'd have to get rid of rock and roll stars. You'd have to get rid of abstract expressionist artists. All of them have high expectations of disaster in their lives. People choose to risk themselves. People choose to risk themselves. It may be that society will arrive at a consensus that this is too violent a sport, but already the sport is trying to contain its more violent aspects with what I think is mixed success.
Well, I mean, given the risks, especially with younger players, especially given the fact that concussions are far worse with children, do you feel some kind of moral ambivalence about children playing this sport, or do you think that the education value outweighs the risks?
At this point, I think that you want to wait until your child is in eighth or ninth grade. You want to make sure that the helmets are good helmets. You want to make sure that the coach teaches you how to tackle with your shoulders. You want to make sure that there are strong rules against head-to-head collisions and that they are enforced. And then if you have a certain sort of son, or in a couple of cases, daughters, I think you give them the green light. I mean, most concussions for young people come from riding bicycles. It's not proportional to the number of concussions that you get playing football, but that's where most concussions come from. You get as many concussions from college soccer as you do college football, but there are many more subconcussive events for college football. There's no doubt about that. It's a dangerous game, but most things that have value are in some measure dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss playing the game?
Oh, yeah. Everybody does. Everybody who had a good experience playing the game misses playing the game. And you'll have to go a long way before you find somebody who says, I regret playing that game, even if they're limping as they're walking towards you to tell you the news.
Hmm. Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
That's Mark Edmondson and Raymond Tungekar. Mark is the author of Why Football Matters, My Education in the Game. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Joe Hartke. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.